Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh,
you're in the madhouse now.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar. Today, we have a guitar player's player. He's a phenomenal artist and an extremely creative musician. We're with Oz Noy. Oz has performed, toured, and recorded with Gavin DeGraw, Harry Belafonte, Cyndi Lauper, Clay Aiken, Wonder Girls, Tony Braxton, Phoebe Snow, Nile Rodgers, John Patitucci, the East Village Opera Company, Roger Glover, Bill Evans, Warren Haynes, and Government Mule. Just a few more. Allman Brothers, Eric Johnson, Mike Stern, Steve Lukather. This list goes on and on literally forever. Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, Foreigner, Patti Smyth, Wiz Khalifa. Literally hundreds of other people. I had to like snip this in a tenth. Oz was born in Israel and he started his professional career at the age of 13 playing jazz, blues, pop, and rock music. By age 16, he was playing with top Israeli musicians and artists. And by 24, he was one of the most established studio guitar players in the country, and he was also a member of the house band on Israel's top-rated television show for more than 2 years. Since 96, when he moved to New York, he's made a huge impact on the local and international music scene. His unique and intoxicating style has broken all the rules of instrumental guitar music by focusing on the groove, and he's a super groovy guy. All stars such as Keith Carlock, Anton Figg, and Vinnie Calo... I always... screw Vinny's last name. Can you pronounce Vinny?
Vinny Kaliuta.
Yeah, Vinny Kaliuta. Thank you. Sorry about that. That's the amazing drummer. Often contribute on drums with bassist Will Lee and Reggie Washington, who I recently interviewed in episode number 206 on this show, also involved. In 2003, Oz released his debut record called Oz Live, which was recorded at New York City's legendary Bitter End. He's since released seven more. Huh?
2001,
my bad. Oz Live.
Oz Live was 2003. Sorry,
that's what I said. Oz.
Oh, you said 2006. Sorry,
we'll get it together here. Don't worry. In 2003, Oz released his debut record, Oz Live, recorded at the Bitter End down in the Village in New York. Right. He's since released seven more albums, including his most recent one, which is like one of the best titles of a record I've ever heard, called "Who Gives a Funk." Oz has two highly acclaimed instructional DVDs, Guitar Improvisational Workout and Play Along Workout, released by jazzhaven.com. He also has two instructional videos with My Music Masterclass, and he's done two videos for True Fire, one of which I own, which is great. He has also won the Best Guitarist on a Record in 2007, Best New Talent in 2008, and Best Out There Guitar Player in Guitar Player Magazine Reader's Poll. Oz also conducts master classes at loads of places, including the Collective School of Music in New York and Musicians Institute in Los Angeles. And I love him because he's got a great hairstyle, just like I do. Man, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time.
Sure, no problem.
Hey, so what's the music scene like in Israel, and how does that compare with the States? And also, what's the state of the music business over there, and is it easier or harder to make a living as a musician?
Well, I haven't lived there in 21 years, so it's harder for me to be specific about how it is right now. But it's as hard to make a living there as it is to make a living in New York. It's kind of the same. It's hard everywhere because, you know, musicians, but there's really, really good jazz education in Israel. So I don't know why and I don't know how, but people really love jazz there. So the level of jazz players that come out of Israel is really, really high. So there's little jazz gigs in Israel, and there's really great players that play. So that's one thing that's kind of a phenomenon because it's such a small country.
Yeah.
In terms of studio work and pop stuff or rock stuff, there's really good stuff that's coming out of there that I like. But I don't know exactly, you know, I don't know how much work there really is there, you know, for everybody to kind of, I think people that are really good work, you know, they don't make the same money as I make in New York or people, but you can make a living playing music there and there's good stuff that's coming out of there. But I don't know how it is exactly today because I haven't been there in so long. Like I go and visit and all my friends work there, but I can't tell.
Sure, sure.
Exactly where it's at. But there's good music coming out of there and there's great players. So I think it's fine.
You know what's interesting? I see sometimes on YouTube, like out of the African countries, man, you'll hear like these really cool, like a guy will be playing an SG and he'll be playing the same notes that we'll play here, but the way they're using it is totally different.
Well, you know, there's a thing there that is only unique to that country. It's like Middle Eastern, it's kind of like Middle Eastern with kind of Arab influences. And there's a very specific guitar style that's played there that's pretty amazing. It's totally, yeah. That's probably what you're talking about.
Yeah.
There's a couple of guys there that are kind of the masters of that. It's kind of like almost like, you know, Greek music has Greek players.
Yes.
And the bouzouki, and then they have the same style on electric guitar, and like you can see in Uzbekistan and places like that, there's this kind of style, and so it's the same thing in Israel. They have a style there of playing that fits a certain type of music. It's more like kind of Middle Eastern music, but it's pretty amazing and it's totally original. Like you have to literally learn the language of it.
Yeah, and but it's like it's kind of like Middle Eastern with pentatonic, but it's not, yeah. It's like the blues ish, but I've never seen anything like it. It's really cool.
Yeah. There's really, I kind of grew up with that stuff around me and I was never a big fan of Middle Eastern music. I always more like rock and, you know, stuff like that. So, or jazz. So, but it was always around me. But now when I'm a little more grown up and I listen to it with perspective. It's really, really unique, you know? Yeah. And the guys that do it are kind of the masters at it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah. What prompted you to move here in 96, and why'd you pick New York?
Well, I wanted to move because I was 24, and I already played with a lot of people there, and you would have been staying there and doing the same stuff, you know? So, and I always wanted to play, you know, with better players and... So I moved to New York just to play, I don't know, to kind of extend my musical abilities, I would say. And then, I don't know, there wasn't really many other options for me in terms of like going somewhere else. Like it was either New York or LA, but since I was pretty young, since I'm 13, people told me, you got to go to New York. I don't know why. It's just at the time, you know? So I just went here. Plus, a lot of the music that I really like kind of came out of here. Plus, the center of jazz is here. There's nowhere else. So it was pretty obvious where I need to go, you know.
Did you know people here when you moved over?
Well, I had a couple of really good friends of mine that I kind of grew up and played with in Israel that became pretty successful here. And they moved here a couple of years before I did. So when I moved here... They were all in the jazz scene, but they're already pretty deep in the jazz scene here. Okay. So I had some good friends, but it really didn't matter because everybody, when you come to New York or anywhere really, when you move your home somewhere else, it's like you kind of create your own destiny. I don't know how to.
Yeah.
So it didn't really matter if I had friends here or not. I kind of chose my own path, you know. I mean, it kind of went a certain way that had nothing to do with them.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah. Well, I think the music community also is really small in when it comes down to it. And if you're, you know, if you're a good player and if you're not a dick, I think people are pretty supportive of you.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Were there any surprises here in the States or New York that you weren't expecting, either musically, culturally, or business-wise?
Well, the main surprise for me was when I moved to New York, the one thing that really shocked me was the jazz scene, and I knew it, but it was just so good. I was just like, oh shit, I gotta really get my shit together, you know. that's the biggest shock. But what took me a while to find was, I thought it would be blues and funk and R&B in New York, and everywhere I went to was pretty lame. I was like, oh, that's not really happening. So that was kind of a shock to the other direction. But then once I started hanging out and meeting people, you started to know where to go and where the good players are playing. And then I started to see good stuff. You know, you got to kind of learn the city a little bit and to see where things are happening. But the thing that was really obvious was the jazz scene. Like right away, I went to Smalls. At the time, Smalls was like the, it still is the place, but I went there, and at the time it was like when Brett Meldow and Brian Blade and Bill Stewart and all those guys were, they were just getting famous. So I would go and see them at the club. I was like, oh God. And Kurt Rosenwinkel was just playing there every week. You know, it was just like, all those guys that now are the next generation of jazz, they were like just getting famous, you know? So it was pretty cool.
Where's Smalls?
It's in the village.
Yeah. You know what, man? I have to tell you, I've never heard of that club. That's amazing. I don't know how.
That's where, you know, here's the thing. The thing is, what most people know about when they go like to New York to hear jazz, about jazz, it's like they know the Blue Note, they know the Village Vanguard, maybe Birdland, you
Iridium.
Know, but Iridium. Yeah. But those are places for established musicians. But the street music is what it's all about in New York. It's all about the street music. So, you know, it's more, it used to be at least where everybody got developed in the small clubs. So Smalls was the club that got so many kind of famous new jazz guys out of there. And another club that is pretty important is the 55 Bar.
Yeah, I know that place because I've met a lot of people that play there.
Yeah, so those, like, to me, those are the two kind of important. There used to be more clubs, they closed, you know. But those are the most important clubs I can think of that are, you know, like street music that you can go and you can hear a famous guy, but you can also hear the upcoming new guy, you know?
Yeah.
Well, and that's what New York is about, really.
So many clubs closed, like, you know, you mentioned the Bitter End. Yeah. There was another one down there called the Bottom Line. Gone.
A lot of places closed. New York is what it used to be, unfortunately, but there's still a little bit of it left to kind of keep it alive, you know?
Sure. Hey, you've worked with a ton of, like, very interesting artists, and I was curious, if I threw out a few names, if you could tell me how you got the gig and the nature of the engagement, and if you have a cool story of working with them. My first one is one of my favorite guitarists. I've seen his band 4 times, and I've seen him about 5 or 6 times. Warren Haynes and Government Mule.
Sure. I don't remember how we met, but I've been kind of friends with Warren for a bunch of years, and yeah, I know what it is. He's the keyboard player at Government Mule, Danny Lewis. I used to play with him in New York, and I guess when I started making records, he told Warren about me, and that's how we met. And I don't remember when was the first time we played, but I think maybe they play the Beacon every year, so I usually come and hang out, and he calls me to sit in.
Yeah, because I have a couple of records with you at the Beacon. Yeah. You sat in, yeah, right.
And the same way I sat in with Government Mule, I sat in with the Allman Brothers. They do it all the – when they used to do that, people used – like every night somebody would come and sit in. So I actually don't live far from the Beacon anyhow. So for me, it's just like when they play, I used to just go and sit in.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Great theater, man. Acoustics there are really
amazing. But, you know, the thing that I can say about Warren and about – when the Allman Brothers was still around, it's kind of the same vibe. It's so stress-free. Like, you go on stage, and it's just so relaxed. And it's the vibe. It's so great. It's like, you know, because it's really stressful to sit in, especially with guys like that, and especially at the Beacon. But you just go up there, and it's just so relaxed. It's like playing with friends. It's really cool, you know? And I've done it, like, a bazillion times there, you know?
Yeah. Is that just because he's like it happens to be an easygoing guy?
Yeah, it's definitely that. Yeah, and it's kind of the culture, I think. You know, it came from the Allman Brothers. It's just like they like to jam, you know. Mm. So it's very relaxed. There's no stress at all.
Yeah, but also, and I'm not blowing smoke up your ass. He only the musicians that there, they're like top of the heap guys. Yeah, you know, he's not calling anybody up there that he's got to worry about. You know,
yeah,
very professional. Excellent players, you know.
Yeah, but the thing is, yeah, that's true. But from my perspective, and I've done it so many times, I'm like the king of sitting in with famous people, you know. There's so much, like, people like me to come and jam, you know. But when you come and jam, you usually play on one song. So you come in, you don't do a sound check or anything. You just bring your guitar, you plug in whatever sound you get. Like, that's it. You got to do it. So it's not, it's pretty stressful, you know, but somehow with him, it's just so relaxed. It's like everybody's just, you know, let it happen. It's all about the music and there's no ego. It's just really great.
Very cool, man.
Yeah.
How about Roger Glover, the bass player from Deep Purple?
Roger, I did a record with him a long time ago. It was like, I can't remember even when. It was like maybe at least 10 years ago, maybe 12 or 13. He just called me because my friend was playing drums with him and he recommended me. And he's great. It was such a great pleasure working with him. He's really, really a good guy and great songwriter. And we did this great record, and I haven't seen him since. No, actually, I saw Deep Purple one time. They're playing Radio City Hall and Radio City, and he got me some tickets. So, but I haven't seen him in years. But it was a great, great experience playing with him. He's a great guy.
How about Mike Stern?
When I moved to New York, the only guy I took a lesson and a half with was Mike. I called him. I was like, hey, can you give me a lesson? So I went to his house to give me a lesson. And then I kind of took another one. But at that point, he likes to play. So he started to call me to his house. And I used to go and play with him all the time. And that's kind of what he does with a lot of people. And then he was working on a record. You kind of help him a little bit with that. I play with him a lot, and we're just kind of good friends now, you know. And he helped me over the years a lot because he's so, you know, we have the same booking agent in Europe and all that kind of stuff. And he actually, I've been working with Dave Weckl for a long time, but he was the guy that kind of connected us, you know. So he has really been very, very supportive of me. Professionally and also kind of personally, is really good, you know, good friend to have, you know.
That's great. That's good. Yeah. That's a nice story. So what are you working on now that you're excited about?
I've been doing for the past year, I have this Boogaloo band. It's called the Boogaloo Experience Band. And I actually started to record a new album. I don't know how to describe it. It's Boogaloo meets Bitches Brew. I don't know. It's like something like that.
That's a first.
Yeah. So I started, the way I make records is I play, I don't go in the studio and record. I play live for a while before I write the tunes. I kind of make sure the band is gelled. You know what I mean? We play enough live and then I go in the studio. So this is the first record that I've done when I'm actually, it's really spread out. So I did one session maybe 4 months ago with Steve Ferroni and Will Lee and Jerry Z. That was the first session. And then I just did 2 weeks ago, I did another session with Vinnie Colaiuta and with John Petitucci and Brian Charette. And there's another session that's coming up in May with Dave Weckl and James Genus and Gary Verses. So that's the latest. I don't know when the record's going to come out. So I don't know yet. I don't know. It's kind of weird now with releasing records because you have to release a record and connect it with some kind of a tour. Otherwise, you can't sell any records because nobody buys any records anymore. So it's almost like you can't just release a record and go like, hey, here it is, because nobody will give a fuck.
Absolutely.
So you kind of have to like do that and make sure you have a tour connected to that that you can promote it. So it's a little trickier. So I don't know yet when it's going to be released.
Where do you typically record?
Well, I usually record in New York at a place called the Carriage House. It's actually in Connecticut. It's a great studio. But this new record I've been doing at Sweetwater. You know the company Sweetwater?
Yeah, out in Indiana.
They have this amazing facility, and they have this kind of situation where they get people to record in their studio, and it's an amazing – it's just an amazing situation, you know? They got, like, the last two Peter Erskine records that was done there. Gene Chi record with Robin Ford, Jimmy Haslip, and Vinny Caliuta has been done there. Carl Verheyen. They do a lot of records there, and it's a really cool situation. So I kind of contact them to ask about it, and they're really interested in it. So I've done it there. It's really cool.
Is it like a regular studio for hire?
It is a regular studio for hire, and it's a really nice studio, but they also have a thing where they bring artists to record, and you do this master class for them. It's the whole thing, but it's great.
Yeah, I get it. They're working it in with their promos.
Yeah, and you do some videos for them. You do interviews, stuff. It's pretty cool. It's really great.
That's really cool, man.
Yeah.
Let me, if this is a possible answer, you've been involved in so many different cool projects. If you had to choose maybe the top three experiences you've had musically, is that possible? Like, which ones left you feeling best about what happened or the experience, or there's a certain thing about it that really meant something to you? I know, tough question.
I don't know. Now I'm blanking out on... you know, my world is usually surrounding around my records. So I do sideman work, and I like to do sideman work. So I actually, some people think that if you're a solo artist, that's all you do. And I'm really not that. And I kind of don't want to be that either. I like to work with other people and do other stuff. So, but when I do other, you know, I've done this really great record with Rob Mattis. He's a really great, like, arranger, producer, I don't know, he's done the last couple of Sting things. He's been doing, like, the White House stuff, like an MD and for that for years. Like, he's probably one of the best, if not the best musician I ever worked with. So I've done this one really good record with him, but nothing ever happened with that. But so sometimes there's those projects that's come up, but mainly what I'm focusing on like, day-to-day life is just my records, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I would say that the things that are cool to me is to do gigs with my band with cool lineup or to play, to do cool sessions for my records. Like I did one with Vinny and with Patitucci recently. Mm-hmm. That was cool. You know, I did one with Ferroni and Will Lee. That's cool. But those things, I don't want to sound like cocky, but I'm used to this stuff, you mm-hmm. know?
No, I totally get it. Yeah. Well, no, you've got a ton of experience.
Yeah, so that's the stuff that I really like. I really like to play with good bands behind me. Mm. There's really nothing like it when you play with a really good rhythm section. It's really great.
Well, you've playing with some, like, Vinny, Will. Those are like, man.
Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of the highlights of my, you know, I've set in and I play with a lot of other people, but that's not as comfortable or as meaningful to me as, you know, doing that kind of stuff.
Playing your own music.
Yeah, but even if it's not my own music, but being in a situation where the band... Yeah, I guess you can say, yeah, playing my own music. But being in a situation when the band is really profoundly good, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's the stuff that I can't think of anything off my head right now that will stick out, you know what I mean?
No, that's all good, man. You grew up in Israel. What was your childhood like?
It was cool. Like nothing. It was, I don't know, normal. You know, really normal middle class upbringing in, you know, suburbs of Tel Aviv, really, you know.
Big family?
Yeah, we're four brothers. Oh, so, wow. You know, my mom and my dad and a dog. But it was, you know, the thing is, I started... playing when I was 10, and my big brother started to bring music, and he started playing bass also. So he had a band shortly after I started playing guitar. So there was the guy that was playing in his band, like the guitar player and singer, used to come to our house. So he used to show me Beatles songs and also the pop songs. So I got advanced really quick, you know? So I started my professional career at a really, really young age, which in some ways is kind of traumatic, but
what do you mean? Traumatic, you know, in what way?
You know, you start working when you're 13 or 14 or 15 and you start doing gigs with like established or semi-established artists when you're like really, really young and you have responsibilities, you know?
Yeah.
So it's it could be kind of, it's not easy. It gets easier when you're 20, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I started professionally in a really young age. Like when I was 15, I started to do recording sessions, you know?
Holy shit. Yeah, that's a lot for a 15. You don't have the coping skills to process all that at that age. Yeah.
Exactly. But I didn't play with Sting when I was 15. I did like local Israeli stuff. But still, I had to play with a click track and play guitars and I'll do all that stuff, acoustic guitar, electric, all that stuff. So, and then when I was 18, I started to play with, actually 16, I started to play with more with like real established people there. But that's pretty much was my upbringing. And then I didn't finish high school or anything like that. So when I was, I guess 16, I just kind of became totally professional, which is another thing that's kind of weird because all your friends go to school and you're at home practicing. But I was able to kind of be focused enough on music that my parents and also myself, they didn't freak out because they saw that I have something positive to do. And the other thing that was really cool with my family is nobody pushed me to either direction. Like nobody told me, hey, do this or don't do that. You know, it was pretty much like, you know, they saw that I played, they saw that I was professional, they just helped me out with whatever they can, but that was it, you know?
So they were just like open and supportive of whatever, as long as you weren't doing anything stupid, they were willing to get behind it, yeah.
Yeah, and it was, and the other thing that was kind of funny is I started making money when I was really young, like not a lot of money, but I started making a living when I was 16, so nobody can really give me shit and go like, hey, you gotta learn a profession, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Which is normally, you know, if you're, you live in a suburb in a small country, you know, you're supposed to go to you do the army, then you go to university, and then you get married and have kids and have a job. So for me, nobody ever told me that because I was making a living since I'm young, you know?
Don't they have mandatory army service there?
They do.
Did you served?
I didn't, but they do.
Interesting. If you could say, is there like, how did you get out of that? Or if you can say, if you can't, that's totally cool.
You can get out of it. It's just like today, it's actually easier to get out of it because they don't want to, if they don't want people that don't want to be there, you know what I mean?
Which makes
sense. At the time, it was a little harder, but I was already really kind of a professional musician at that age. It was like a waste of time.
Yeah.
To even go there. Plus, I'm not really good with this kind of like all these environments where, you know, you got a very structured thing and, you know.
No, I totally get that.
I'm a rebel, so.
Were you, just curious, in the pecking order, you said there's four boys. Where were you?
Two.
Because sometimes, as I was thinking, because I've got three kids, and you, as a parent, you get much more lenient and with each successive kid.
Oh, wow.
You know, like there's a joke, like, you know, if your first child drop some food on the floor, you know, oh my God, let me take that. You know, you can't have that. The second one, you just like wash it and give it back to him. And then the third one, you just don't even care. You just like eat it right off the floor because you just realize like, you know what, there's certain things are, you become better at parenting basically. And you realize what's important and what's not important and what you should get stressed out about and what you should stress your kid out about. Yeah, so I was just curious like where you were, like, cause you know, if you were like at the bottom, they probably said, oh, we're not going to fight, you know, cause four kids is a lot. You get, as a parent, you get burned out, man.
I don't know how my parents did it. You know, my big brother was playing bass, so we used to play together. And now he's a scientist. He's pretty much like the smartest guy I know, you know. So he's like a, you know, a researcher and, you know.
That's a very big career niche over in Israel's known for, like, you know.
Oh, he's really
cutting edge.
Really, really, really serious. I'm not going to be surprised if one day he's going to win a Nobel Prize or something, you know. Like, he's that serious. you know.
That's cool, man.
Yeah, so, and then there's me, and then my other two brothers, they all kind of play guitar a little bit, but one is more into the, like, they both in high tech, you know, do, like, computer stuff, and web design, all that kind of stuff. You know?
Very cool, man.
So I'm the only one that's survived the music business.
Well, you haven't just survived, you're doing really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're doing really well. Let me, along those lines, let me ask you this, that, you know, everybody pays tuition in their career, all of us, whatever we're doing. And I was wondering if you'd be kind enough to maybe share one or two mistakes you might have made along the way, and what were the lessons you learned from the mistakes?
Oh. You know, I think I can't, I got to really think through this and see if I can't think about a specific thing that I did that I would say, oh, if I would have done it different, things would be different.
Not necessarily things that you like regretted, but just like at normal mistakes you might have made, and you learned a lesson. Okay, that's the first time, last time I make that mistake.
Well, I don't know if this is a mistake, but I would think that, you know, growing up, it was a total different idea in your head than what the music business really is. So I would say, if I could have done things differently, then first of all, I would go to music school and learn music. Like, I know that I don't know music, but I would do it in a way where it's a little more, I still would like to do it just like a little more academic.
Yeah.
And the other thing is I would learn business. Shit.
That's the number one thing that I get out of musicians.
Man, it's like, I wish I could learn music, business, because that's the hardest thing, because your brain doesn't function on those levels. And now more than ever, it's the music business, you know? So that's really, that's like my regrets, let's say, if I could have kind of gone backwards. But, you know, the other thing is, I think maybe New York is more than other places, but you keep paying your dues here all the time in like little ways, you know what I mean? Like it's big ways in the beginning, but even now, you know, because the music business doesn't exist anymore and it's changed so much that it's like you kind of have to adapt. So you keep paying your dues all the time.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think New York in particular, having grown up there myself, it's a survival of the fittest, like a Darwin, the principle of survival of the fittest exists there all the time. And you're getting tested in various ways all the time there. It's not an easy place to live.
Plus, the other thing is when the music business started to crash and the whole thing kind of fell apart, the place that got hurt the most is New York.
As far as clubs and...
Everything, clubs, work for musicians, recording session, movies, everything got hurt so bad because New York's become like this kind of like rich people's colony, and you can't, unless you have support for the arts here, like music, it doesn't, people move out of New York to Nashville or to LA because you don't have enough work here, and all the business, like all the industry moved out of here. So it's pretty messed up, you know?
Man, I used to walk down Bleecker Street. It used to be my favorite street in the city because there was so much cool shit going on there.
Yeah.
And all these funky stores and bars.
There's still a little bit of it, but not as much as it used to be.
Oh, yeah, nowhere near. It's like every time I go, there's another thing missing. Like my favorite pizza shop, Pizza Box, is on there. That's fucking gone.
Yeah, they're making it like... it's kind of sad what's happening in New York. I hope something will turn around. But they're making it like luxury condos. And like it's like a place for rich people to live. They suck all the soul out of it.
Yeah, it has. It has. And it's disappointing. And like you still have a little bit of it in the East Village. But even that, a lot of that's been cut away, man. The grittiness. There's no like grit anymore. Or like bohemian sort of. Enclaves, no. Yeah, it's a little disappointing.
It's still a little bit, but that little bit is disappearing. I don't know what's going to be happening here in like 10 or 20 years from now. Because what makes a city cool is the art, the artist. You know, that's why New York is New York. People don't come here to look at Banks and Dwayne Reed. You know what I mean? So it's like, It's pretty sad, you know, but hopefully something will turn around.
I hope so. Even like it used to be, you could walk down in any place in the village and there'd be like our unique little t-shirt shop.
Oh, absolutely.
And it was so fucking cool. And now they can't afford to be there, man. You can't sell t-shirts and pay 20 grand a month in rent.
Exactly. Plus, it's not only that, if you think about that in terms of the music, because it's like the only clubs that are still open, I think, are clubs that have leases, or either the owners own the building or they have old leases. Otherwise, if you want to open a music club in New York, you have no chance today. Like, no chance. So it affects the music here, like the business, extremely, you know. So it's definitely a bummer.
Yeah, it's definitely been a big change. Let me ask you this. If you had to go back and give advice to the younger Oz,
yeah,
let's say 25 or 30 years old, what would you have advised him that you know now a little smarter and wiser?
Don't worry, it'll be okay. Things will work out.
Don't worry. Yeah, man, isn't that funny how that works?
I know, yeah. It's like things will work out, you know. Just don't be so stressed out about every little thing, you know.
I hear you, man. Hey, let's talk gear for a few minutes. You got a beautiful Strat in your hands, but what's your go-to guitar right now, and what other two guitars might round out your top three?
My go-to guitar has been always the same thing. It's my Strat. I have a 68 custom shop that it's either I have one Rosewood and one Maple. So Rosewood is more of like kind of my number one, but my Maple one is a better guitar. So I kind of go between those. And then I would say my number two guitar is a Tele. And recently I've been playing a bunch of Les Paul, so I would say my number three will be a Les Paul.
What? Those are custom shop from 68, or they're
no, it's custom shop
reissue. Okay, they're reissues.
I don't have any vintage gear. It's like, unfortunately, it's stupid, but it's too expensive to.
Oh, it's crazy expensive.
Not really worth the money, to my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how people. I hear people. I just bought a 59. Original Les Paul. I'm like, how the fuck did you do that?
I don't know. It's for collectors only. It's not for players, you know?
Yeah. And it, yeah, right, because you can't...
If you want to travel with this, what are you going to do? Travel with a $20,000, $30,000 guitar, or like with a $100,000 guitar? Yeah. It's insane.
Yeah, it is crazy.
Yeah.
Are there any interesting or cool stories behind how you acquired any of your guitars?
Actually, yeah. Like the I used to have a custom shop, Maple Strat, like a 57 custom shop, you know, and I used it for a while and it was really nice. And then Fender came out with this 68 custom shop, you know, model. It was about 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago. And I went to the stores and played them and I thought they were really good, but I didn't like the locking, the tuners, and they had ash bodies. And I was like, you know, they're good guitars, but it's not quite right. So then I got in with Fender and I called the A&R guy that I was working with and I asked him, can I order that guitar? And he said, basically, this model is out of, they don't make that model anymore, but if you want to alter it to make it whatever you want, then we can make it. So I was like, oh, wow, perfect.
That's what you wanted, yeah.
Exactly. So I basically ordered the exact same guitar, but with an older body and with vintage tuners. And when I got that Strat, it was just like really good. I freaked out. So I immediately ordered another one that was a Maple one. And that one was actually even better. So it just turned out really, really good. I was like, wow. I got lucky twice. After that, I tried to order some more stuff from them.
What are you playing now? Is that one of them?
Yeah,
is that the Maple one?
Yeah.
Is that neck relic or is that your?
No, it's. I've done some to it, but it's very. It's but they're both heavy relics. So.
Okay, because that's a Maple, really cool.
They're a little too relic, to my opinion, but I don't care. It's like,
it's cool looking, man. It sounds great. They always say, you know, what a guitar sounds like unplugged is a good indication of what, and that's been sounding great. Why do you like the Maple one? How do you said it's even better? You prefer a Rosewood neck, but the Maple guitar.
It's just the Maple guitar just turned better. It's just a better guitar. I don't know.
Sounds better.
Yeah, I went to the custom shop a couple of times, and when I was in LA, I went to Corona, and I asked the guys there. I was like, "Can you do anything to my Rosewood that would make it sound as good as my Maple?" And it's just like the maple guitar is just a better, in terms of the level of the instrument, it's just better. We tried to switch the body and it didn't work out, so I kind of gave up on it. It's just, it is what it is.
Gotcha. Who is there anybody who influences your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
Interesting question.
Well, you know, I used to ask who influenced your playing, but it's all the same, everybody, you know. So is it, if I find out what's different, you know, it's a little
more
interesting.
But, you know, here's the thing. This is something that people that don't know my history wouldn't know, but I was a Wes Montgomery clone for a bunch of years. Like, I actually played with a thumb, and I used to have a jazz band in Israel where I play all Wes Montgomery music. I used to be able to play full Wes Montgomery records by heart with a record, like with the solos, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, so that's basically my plan is a mix of bebop and R&B and blues. So I'm basically a jazz musician, you know? So I come from that, Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, the Wes Montgomery. That's kind of where I, you know, a lot of my stuff comes from. So
Grant Green?
Yeah, of course. Grant Green, Kenny Burrell. Yeah, big time. But I was a real Wes Montgomery clone. I was playing with a thumb. I was doing the whole thing. I had a jazz, like a kind of an Epiphone L5 shitty guitar that I used to... A friend of mine once, I had this American friend of mine in Israel, who's a great guitar player named Ronnie Peterson. And one time when I was doing this thing, he came to this club. And, you know, I used to be redheads. I'm really white. And I had this guitar that was... also a blonde guitar, and he saw me play this, and he goes, like, you look like the negative of George Benson.
That's funny. The negative of George Benson.
Yeah. I still play jazz. I actually, yesterday, I did a gig at the 55 Bar. You know, I play standards, and I do all that stuff. I do it my way, but... that's where I come from, you know what I mean? Yeah. The records that I make, a lot of people think that it's kind of, because it's groove-oriented music, I think they kind of miss the point that I'm actually a jazz player and I, you know.
What makes you, how come you don't make jazz records then?
I am planning on it. I just never got to a point where, I almost did it a couple of years ago. It's just, I make records when I think I have something to say and I have a concept for it, so... I had a couple of years ago, I was doing a bunch of gigs with Petatucci and Jeff 10 Watts, and it really sounded good. Like, I have those ideas of standards and all these arrangements and stuff that I do on it. And we've done a bunch of gigs, and it was really cool. And I thought, wow, we should record it. But let's say I didn't have the balls to do it yet. I can do a jazz record tomorrow if I want to. Like, I have like, idea arrangements and all this stuff for tunes that I can, and I still do it. I try to make sure that I play once a month in New York, like I play the 55 Bar, and I do that to just keep it going. But I don't know, I still just don't feel like I'm at that place where, okay, it's time to do it, you know. But I will do it.
Yeah, you should, because I'll tell you what, from a marketing standpoint, I bet your ability to sell a jazz record, there's less competition there than...
I think there's competition everywhere.
Really? But I tell you what, when I interviewed Randy Johnston, who I think you know.
Johnston.
The passion and the fervor behind all the people that contacted me about that interview was, honestly, it was probably the highest, you know, up there with, and I've done 200 interviews I put out. So it was, that community is, I got the sense that community is really, really tight.
You know, what's interesting about, you know, I consider what I'm doing jazz, but it's more electrified. So, you know, like Scofield and Stern came out of the Miles Davis band, so they can do that stuff. They can do whatever they want. And it will be considered jazz. But for somebody like me that came out doing the electric stuff, it's like kind of, it's not acoustic jazz. You know what I mean? It's not like spread ahead stuff. So for me, it's a little harder, but that's what I kind of came up with. I still consider those jazz records, but they're not considered as jazz, like in like the, when people market it, you know what I mean? It's like more like blues mixed with I don't know what. It's like So if I do a jazz record, it's definitely going to have a, it's a whole other market. There's a lot more work in it in Europe.
Oh, yeah.
People are more, and in certain places that just people are more into like the swing aspect of it, you know?
Definitely.
So I'm aware of it, but I'll find the right time to do it. Eventually I'll do it.
Good, man. That'd be great to hear. Yeah. Musically, you talked about a bunch of music you listened to. If I asked you for your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and knowing that this can change tomorrow or any time, what's your knee-jerk reaction to the top three CDs?
Pat Metheny Group, Still Life Talking. Gaucho, Steely Dan.
Oh, yeah, that's a great album.
Yeah. The first Electric Band record. Those are, to my opinion, those are like maybe the three records that, there's a few more, but that influenced me the most.
Electric Band.
The first Chick Corea
Electric. Oh, Chick Corea, okay, yeah.
Yeah. Those are like big marks in my, you know, development, I can say. Mm. But then there's a lot of jazz records, just like, you know. I can't think about it right now. But those are the three that just like,
yeah.
Boom,
yeah.
You know.
What is something that you've...
Midnight Blue. Kenny Burrell, Midnight Blue. Yeah. And any Stevie Ray Vaughan record, of course.
Oh, now you're getting out of control. You only had three, man. And Eric Johnson. What's something that you've learned about yourself along this whole journey you've been on?
I guess that I can handle a lot more than I think I could. You know what I mean?
Sure.
You know, it's like, it's interesting. You don't realize that doing what you do as a musician is very physical. Not physical in terms of holding a guitar and playing a guitar. It's like, you know, most of the lifestyle is not sleeping in regular hours. Like the lifestyle is very unregular and the traveling is very physical. You know, so it's kind of like you have to really have your shit together physically to handle a lot of it, and mentally, you know, also it's like a lot of mental stuff. So that's kind of stuff that I wasn't really aware of, you know, when I started playing or when I moved here, you know.
Do you train or work out? Because you're in pretty good shape. You seem like you're pretty fit.
I tried to do yoga as much as I could. In the summer, I try to run when I'm around, you know. I try my best, you know. Yeah. Yeah. But it's... You know, I've read an interview with Pat Metheny, or not read, I saw an interview with Pat Metheny when he started touring when he was really young, right after he graduated. He wasn't even graduating Berkeley, he was already teaching. He just went in a van and started touring. And, you know, your body gets adjusted to a certain lifestyle that it's most people can't really handle, you know. So, you know, like I was just in Japan now for like 5-6 days playing 3 shows. You're jet lagged out of your mind, you know what I mean? It's really hard for your body, and people don't understand that. And that's something that, you know, musicians that tour a lot. I don't tour a lot. I tour some, but not a lot. But somebody like Pat Metheny or like some of the guys that I play with, like Dave Weckl, they're on constant jet lag. Mike Stern, they're constantly jet lagged. They're just, their bodies are just used to this kind of lifestyle of moving around. But it's physically hard, you know?
Yeah, I do know. That's why the first thing I said to you.
And because it's physically hard, it's mentally hard. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, definitely. When the first thing I said when you told me you were in Japan for a week, I was like, a week? That's it? Because I do under that's brutal.
Yeah, and the other thing that you get used to is, you know, Japan is actually fun because you play in the same club, but when you do those European tours, or U.S. is a little easier because you're in a, you know the terrain, you know you're from here, but when you do those European tours, man, you can be in a different country every day for a month. It's exhausting. So you get used to playing exhausted and getting like the rest whenever you get it. It's just bizarre. I never knew when I started playing that this is kind of what it is, you know?
Well, plus you're going around from one day in one place, the next day in the next place. You don't really have a time to even like catch your breath because you just get used to
Switzerland for a week, and now you're in, you know, Belgium.
For a week. How about Switzerland for a day, and then Greece for a day, and then Spain for a day, and then that's, you know, and if you have a day off, usually you're just resting because it's really exhausting. It's really not what people think it is.
Yeah.
And you have to be mentally, you know, like equipped to it. And physically too, you know. Some people don't tour because they can't handle it.
Do you treat your body well when you're on the road? I mean, do you party a lot?
I try my best, but it's really, really hard.
Yeah.
You know, I don't eat crap, and I try to, I can't exercise when I'm on the road, so that takes that out of the equation. It never feels good to me. I don't like to tour. I do it because I have to, but, you know, I don't mind going somewhere and being in one place. Like when I go to Japan, you're in one place, so that's kind of cool. You know, it's easier, but still, you got to deal with jet lag, you know?
And it's a big place. You got to go travel around. Japan's not a tiny little place.
No, but when I just went now, it was just in Tokyo, so it's the same club. It's easy. But that usually doesn't happen. Usually you go and you play, you move from one place to the next. And then if you have to fly, you know, flying these days is a nightmare. So
it's not
pleasant anymore. So you just deal with all this stuff. You know, you just have, it's pretty stressful, you know.
It is. And I hear that a lot from many musicians who travel frequently. It just, you know. Well, it's 3 hours wind up just before you get to the airplane.
Exactly, yeah. And then, you know, there's all this bullshit getting on the plane or getting off the plane and delays. And you know, I don't know. I, to be totally honest, I try to tour as little as possible. I just tour whenever I have to, or if there's a gig that offers me a lot of money that pays. Like, you know, I did this summer tour with, you know, Idina Menzel.
Yeah.
So I got called last minute to do that. It's like a pop gig. So, you know, I was like, you know, but I did that because the money was really, really good. And you know, it's also a little easier traveling in a way when you do this kind of stuff than the jazz stuff. But if it was up to me, most of the stuff that I do, I would just stay home. And if there was enough stuff for me to do at home, I wouldn't do some of that other stuff.
Do you do tracks at home, out of your studio?
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I don't know. I can say it in relation to music. I don't know if personally is there anything. I'm a pretty regular guy. I think musically, people have this idea of me liking complicated music and odd meters and all this stuff. And I'm really, like being all into like fusion and all this stuff. And I'm really not into that at all. I just like pop music and I like melodies and cool grooves and simple shit.
Yeah, but you were a Wes Montgomery clone. That's totally opposite.
No, that's not opposite. That's jazz. That's like straight out of, I'm talking about like really intricate, like, you know, like fusion kind of complicated music. I'm not into that at all.
Why would people think you're into that?
Because some people that listen to my records, because it's electric and there is all this kind of like some intricate time signature sometimes, they kind of think that I'm into that stuff. But my music has always been about just like playing a groove. There's mostly no time signatures. It's mostly like 4/4. It's just the writing can be a little tricky sometimes. But it's always come from like groove and from simple melodies and stuff. So people kind of get the wrong idea about it. The reason I know it is because a lot of time people want me to play with them or to play on their tracks, and they send me all this shit, and I go like, fuck, this is really complicated. I'm really not into this at all.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah, when I listen to you play, it's super creative. To me, whatever you're doing serves the song.
I would certainly hope so. You know?
It's not like just going on some nutty freak show jag or anything like that.
I think the thing that people are most surprised about me is that I actually really like pop music a lot.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I like Katy Perry. I like Rihanna. I like all the shit that's on the radio. I fucking love it.
What? Do you listen to radio?
Not on the radio. I mean, like, you know, like top 40 stuff. Like, I don't like hip hop that much because a lot of it is crap. But I just like, you know, I grew up on the Beatles, so I like songs and production. And so that's like, that's something that a lot of people are, I guess, will be surprised. Like, when I was on tour, I was with some other guys in the band, you know, and I knew all the, like, the top 40 stuff. And they go, like, how do you know that? I thought you were a jazz guy.
Is there radio in New York? Like, is WNEW still there? I don't even know.
I don't know.
It's interesting. Most important person in your life?
I guess I don't have a girlfriend now for a while, so I can't say, you know, I can say my ex-girlfriend was my most important, but right now...
Are you taking applications, man? Here's a,
All
right. Oz is taking applications from all you women out there.
The next most important people in my life.
For the next...
My family is the most, you know.
Sure. What's the most important thing your dad taught you?
He still tried to teach me the same old thing, which is like, it's going to be okay. Don't worry. Things will fall into place.
And how about your mom? What's the most important thing she ever
taught
you?
My mom's not around anymore. But
I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, no, that's cool. My mom was really cool. She was just like very laid back. She wasn't, you know, she hasn't been around for a while, but, no, just like 5 years, but, there's nothing specific from her. She's just like cool, you know?
Sure, sure. Yeah. What's your favorite New York City food, man?
All of it. Like. Well, you know, I guess New York pizza is cool because it's got.
Oh, man, it's so good.
Pizza, but it's New York, you know?
It's so good.
But also, the Cuban food is good here, the Indian food is good here, the Italian food is good here. Japanese food, when you go to Japan, you realize that in order to get that same level, you have to spend so much more money here in New York. But you can get all the good stuff here. Just sometimes you have to just pay the price for it. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's funny. When I come to New York, man, this is really funny. I think I eat pizza like maybe twice a day. When if people say, oh, it's expensive to eat there, I'm like, not if you just eat pizza. or you have a bagel once in a while, you know.
Yeah, I guess that's the New York stuff, man.
Yeah, man,
but you can get everything here. It's just that you have to, if you want the really legit Italian food, you might have to pay some money. If you want the real real good Japanese food, you really have to pay some money. But you know, you get good Chinese. You know, it's like there's good stuff here.
You know, it was real interesting. I grew up in the Bronx, and there were these Cuban Chinese restaurants.
Oh yeah, I have one right in front of my house. It's the shit.
I know, man. And I used to go because I went there. I'm like, I was talking to these guys. I'm like, how is a Cuban Chinese? He goes, well, in Cuba, there's a big Chinese population. And I was like, I didn't know that, man. And there's tons of these restaurants, and they have really good shit like mofongo, and it's cool stuff, man.
Yeah, it's really good.
Hey, do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music?
No.
Just music, 24/7 pretty much for you?
Yeah. I kind of have a joke that my hobby is flying business class. because I just the flying thing became such a drag now that every time I live my life, just like my whole existence is surrounding around, you know, if I can upgrade my flight to business or get a, you know, business flight, it just makes my life so much better. So my joke is that my hobby is to fly business.
You know, there's a lot of Facebook groups devoted to that.
Seriously?
Yeah, man. Yeah. There's a lot of Facebook groups devoted to like how to leverage miles on a credit card.
I do that. I've been doing it for years. It's just, I don't know, when you travel like the way musicians do, it makes your life just like it's either put light in it or make it dark, you know. It's like it really makes a difference. So
I can't blame you.
And it also affects you physically, you know. If you have to fly to Japan 14 hours in coach,
yeah,
it's really not great.
No, not at all, man.
So that's my hobby.
Good for you. I can't blame you.
Yeah.
Last question, Oz.
and I really appreciate your time. What's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate and how much has just been a part of natural aging?
You know, I guess physically things change, you know, like you start to have aches and pains that you didn't have before, that everybody knows that shit. So you have to start dealing with that. And then when you do, when you deal with that and have to, and travel, that can actually make things harder, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I guess that's one thing. I think on a personal level, because things have, you know, things are never the same. Things are always changing. So I think because of the drastic change in my profession, you know, like the music business, you have to, and also in like the world where, you know, New York suddenly becomes this like colony for rich people. Like you just have to accept a lot of things that you go like, okay, well, this is what it is. I guess I can't change that. I have to just roll with it. And I, you know, I'm not happy about what New York has become, and I'm not happy about the music business, but you have to just learn to deal with that. So I guess it's a complicated answer.
Do you think your ability to handle change now is better than it was in the past? Yeah.
Yes, because you have no choice. You have to deal with it.
Yeah, this isn't something you could be like, well, fuck you, I'll show you.
You have to just surrender to it because you got no other way around. No, you got no choice.
Sure, man.
You don't. So I don't know if it's the most pleasant thing to go through, but it's a part of life, I guess. I guess I learn now when I'm 45, you know.
Well, I've been working for myself. I'm 54 since I'm like 34, 35. And one thing I will tell you is, as an entrepreneur, change is the number one thing. If you're not an adaptable person,
exactly,
no matter what business you're in, you're not going to survive.
It's true.
It's every business, you know, and it's the internet's changed things, and then that changes moving forward, and you got to really be able to roll with the punches, like you said, you know. So I agree with you, man.
You know, I think at least it's my, I'm able to musically at least adapt to things, you know what I mean? Like I, as long as the musical part of it, I'm still inspired to do stuff and I'm still interested and in doing new things all the time. As long as that, I have that fire, then everything else is cool, you know, that everything else kind of falls into place. You just have to adjust to it.
Sure.
I'll be worried when that fire is going to be gone. Hopefully it never will be. But,
well,
you know.
Well, I'm sure it goes from time to time, or it's challenged, because that's not reality, that it could be, you know, every relationship you have, whether it's with a person or with an instrument or a concept, is challenged from time to time, I find anyway. And, you know. Well, listen, man, I appreciate it. Let me tell people where they can find you online. First of all, it's Oznoy at oznoy.com, O-Z-N-O-Y. He's on Instagram and Facebook as well. His new project is called Ozone Squeezed. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Oz?
Yeah, that's a kind of a side project that I've done. The guy from the record company that I'm on is called Abstract Logic. And that's where you can get all my records and stuff. And he talked to me about doing something with a singer for a long time, and this year I wasn't releasing any records. So he's the guy from the record company. He's like, let's do it. So I found this guy named Ray Thistlethwaite. He's an Australian guy that lives in LA. He's a really amazing singer and also a songwriter, and he plays left-hand bass and keyboards together. So he sings, plays left-hand bass and keyboards, and he's really amazing. So I connected with him, and then the guy from the record company recommended this drummer from Atlanta named Darren Stanley. So we started this band, and I had the concept for years, like, because I've been doing this kind of little bands like that in New York for years, where I get a singer that plays usually, and we just take cover tunes and we play them, but then we open them up, you know, and we jam on them and stuff. So that was the idea, and then the guy, Ray, has a couple of originals. So we recorded a couple of original songs of his and then a couple of covers. And It's basically, I call it my pop jam band. It's kind of a pop band in a way, but we stretch out and we play. It's super fun. That's where I was in Japan. That was with that band. So that's that.
And that's called Ozone Squeeze, and people can find that on abstractlogic.com. That's Oz's record company. Is this did you guys record this on tracks or in a studio? You did your tracks there here in the heat of it?
We did it all together.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. Because it's really about, you know, it's really about a band playing, you know. You got to hear it, but it's like we're performing together. We're talking about doing another record and doing it the other way, where each of us will, you know, overdub. But this one, last record, the first one we did was live in the studio.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Good to hear that. So check Oz out at abstractlogic.com. And also, on his website at oznoy.com, again, that's OZNOY.com, he's got some really cool courses that he's done there for Music Institute, for True Fire, and for Jazz Haven. So check those out. And he does occasionally take on new students for lessons, either in person or Skype. And if you're serious about that, A, you got to be at least an intermediate player, and B, you have to go to his website and just contact him through the contact form on there and let him know the kind of stuff you're doing. And if it's a fit, I'm sure he'll get back to you. And check out his playing. He's a phenomenal player. Really good, really creative guy. Man, I really appreciate your time. Any final words of wisdom?
No.
There you go. Man, thank you. It really appreciate it.
Just eat your vegetables and get a good night's sleep. I don't know.
There you go. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. I want to thank Oz Noy again for being generous and transparent and telling us all the cool stories and for spending his time with us. I truly appreciate it. Please check him out online. He's a hell of a player. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified of future episodes along with early product announcements and discounts. And remember, this is important. Happiness is a choice, so choose wisely, man. Be nice, go play a guitar, and most important, have some fun. Till next time, thanks for listening. Peace and love, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.